May is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by the lexicographical legend that is Susie Dent. Now, for people in the UK, Susie needs absolutely no introduction. She is a bona fide national treasure. She has been on my TV in my living room every tea time for as long as I can remember, in her position as chief wordsmith on Channel 4's Countdown, as well, of course, as 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown, the comedy show with Jimmy Carr. She has done so much other stuff. She's written loads and loads and loads of books. They're all fantastic. We have read most of them, I would say, in the QI office. The best thing you can do, really, about Susie's books is to just go to your book repository of choice and ask them for Susie Dent books, because every single one of them is an absolute banger, and you will find so many facts in there. She has also written some novels. She's written one called Guilty by Definition, which is out in the bookshops now. There is also another one upcoming called Death Writ Large, which I dare say you will be able to get on pre-order. Susie is also on tour right now. She is going around the UK telling people loads of facts and loads of amazing anecdotes about words. They're going to be absolutely fantastic shows. I'm certain about it. So if you live in the UK anywhere, then just go to the internet and search for Susie Dent Tour. You could go to nothird.co.uk, N-O-T-H-I-R-D.co.uk. But I've just tried it. If you go to Google, search for Susie Dent Tour, you will find information there. One more thing to say, of course, is to remind you about Club Fish. Go to patreon.com/clubfish to find out more about that. In the Plenty More Fish tier, you can hear more from Susie in our extra long episode, but there's so much more stuff on there. I'm not going to go into it all now. We've said it enough times. There is stuff for free there. There is stuff for paid. It's supporting the podcast. We appreciate if you do it. We understand if you don't. Don't worry about it. The podcast, as we always say, will always be free. And speaking of said free podcast, it's time to get on with it. So, no more to say apart from on with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with Andrew Hunter Murray, James Harkin, and Susie Dent. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Susie.
My fact is that the original Todd in the phrase, on your Todd, died on his Todd. So this was James Foreman Sloan, but Todd Hunter was his middle name. And the Todd bit was a bit of a cruel nickname that his father had given him because he was extremely small and he was originally called Toad by his father. And he was a jockey. Because of his small stature, that was the one thing that he was hugely successful at. And he was the toast of society in the US. He was an incredibly successful jockey. And then he actually came over to England. He rode for the Kings. He rode the King's horses. But then he was accused of insider betting.
Yes.
Which he was later exonerated of, actually.
Was he?
But he was effectively cancelled in today's terms. And he wrote a kind of autobiography, which talked about him basically being on his own. But he did very much died a sad death from cirrhosis of the liver, in fact.
Dear. It wasn't just a celebrity jockey for the fact that he was great at his sport. He was quite a socialite as well, wasn't
yes.
he?
Was
he sort of was all over at parties. He was hanging out with the rich and famous. He did a pretty special thing, which is that he opened a bar in France. It was called New York Bar. And he basically bought an existing bar that was in New York, put it in boxes, brought it over, and he opened it up in Paris, and it became Harry's Bar. Which is the famous bar which Ernest Hemingway used to go to. Ian Fleming has James Bond visit it in one of the novels. Like, it's an iconic bar during World War One.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we all know Harry.
So he was a great jockey. I'm more interested in the horse racing side of it. He said that his biggest trick in horse racing was that he would whisper in the ear of his horses and ask them to run faster.
Is that the insider betting? Or
it was rumoured that he was giving his horse some substances that makes him run faster.
What? In the ear?
Not in the ear.
Sorry.
Usually it happened up the bum.
He was pretty close to them because he pioneered the monkey crouch position, didn't he?
Yes, that's the amazing thing. So he would sort of crouch on his horse and ride it. And when he first came to Europe, everyone took the mickey out of him. They were like, oh, what are you doing? This, you look like an idiot.
What were people doing before that?
Sitting on the horse, maybe?
Sitting back like a...
Oh, like up, yeah, upright, sitting upright. I think.
And what's he doing?
He's doing it... Think of the classic position in jockey racing where they're leaning on the front of the horse. They're sort of crouching
right
forward.
Oh, they're on the neck. Yeah.
Like, imagine if you're cycling in the Tour de France, you might be crouched forward.
Okay, I'm on it. Pretty stunning to invent a new way of riding on a horse.
It's like, yeah.
Like incredible. I think humans have been doing for 8,000 years... But I think I can improve it.
I think, to be fair, I think he popularized it as opposed to being the very first person to do it. Right. I think a few people were testing it out, but they didn't expect the Todd Sloan to suddenly be monkey crouching everywhere. He was in movies as well.
Was he?
Yeah, he was an early Hollywood star.
When was he alive?
Sorry, so this was in the 1930s that he'd be making the movies. He was in a movie called Painting the Town, in which he plays a jockey called Todd Sloan. Then he was in a movie called Madison Square Garden, in which he plays a jockey called Todd Sloan. Then he was in a movie called When Romance Rides. I'll give you a clue from the plot. Lucy Bostil, daughter of a Colorado ranch owner, is led by a dog to his master, Lynn Sloan. Now, what do you think he was called in that movie?
James.
Holly. Yeah. Did not have the name. Outrageous. So and he was in that movie with another actor called Frank Hayes. Does that name ring any bells with you guys?
Yeah.
Do you remember in 1923, there was a jockey who died?
Oh, he died halfway through the race.
Yeah, and won the race while dead.
No.
It's a different Frank Hayes. But who also died in 1923?
What is going on?
What is going on? You two are murder mystery writers. What's going on? Two Frank Hayeses die?
This is bad plotting. I'm going to say it.
Yeah. Implausible.
So Todd Sloan is an example of rhyming slang, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm on my Todd Sloan.
Oh, on your own. Yes. Sorry.
I never put that together.
Yes, that's what I should have said. Interesting.
Because I'm very interested in it. Because you read about rhyming slang, and then it sounds like people say, it's thieves' language from the 19th century. But I don't understand how thieves would gain an advantage and, you know, it'd help them avoid the police or whatever. Yeah. I don't understand how saying use your loaf instead of use your head, loaf of bread.
It's not like he escapes up the apples and pears and the police are actually looking for the greengrocers.
Yeah, exactly.
He must be in here somewhere.
Exactly. I don't really get it. It's quite murky.
The best theory that I know is that actually it originated amongst the costermongers of London who sold costards, which were these sort of sour apples. So they're called costermongers. And they would want to talk about their deals in a coded shorthand that other people couldn't understand. But it was also banter. You know, it had this sort of playful element to it.
Because actually these guys would be the worst possible people to use different words for apples and pears, wouldn't they?
Exactly.
Yes, you're right.
They would want to use apples and pears. Yeah. But they do draw, quite a lot of them do draw on those kind of basic sort of food stuff that they sold at the market.
So I'm so sorry. We talked about butcher's slang, which they still use, don't they?
Yes, pig Latin in a way. Yeah,
and they say words backwards.
Yes.
Oh, in Australia.
Ref Club. Yeah, I spoke to a couple of butchers and they literally would be sent home to learn stuff for the next day. And they talk about their customers. They would, I loved it. It was deliberate shorthand.
We talked about this on the show. I don't think you were on that episode, Susie. And I think I got it from you. Because you wrote this extraordinary book, which is all about the current day slang that's being used by every different kind of grouping.
All the shorthands.
So, yeah. Who had the most?
Butchers were great. Freemasons, as you would expect, quite a few. Birders had loads. Paramedics, I mean, we all have them, only we're not tuning into other people's because we're so busy lobbing our own at others. I mean, cyclist. Honestly, it would be very hard to say who had the most, but it might well be Butcher's in terms of sort of keeping it going as a deliberate sort of tribal thing where you exclude others.
And paramedics, I suppose it's useful if you're trying not to say this person's your arm's come off. They need to say to their colleague, this patient's arm has come off, but without alarming the patient.
Yes. So it's... Exactly, lots of euphemisms. And they also, a group of paramedics told me, which you will have heard, but whenever they were being told off by their bosses, they would just say, there we are then. And there we are then is an acronym for exactly what they thought
Very
of the person
good.
Telling them.
Yes. I'll be using that. There we are then.
But it's interesting you're talking about Todd being a socialite, because so was Gordon Bennett, who was the son of a newspaper magnate, and he was a huge socialite, and that was why his name really stuck in the imagination. And plus, it's a handy sidestep for, you know,
he was big.
Gore blimey.
He sent Stanley out to find Livingstone, who was Gordon Bennett.
Yes.
And so many people just don't know that name. They just think it's an exclamation. But there was a Gordon Bennett. Yeah.
There was a Jack the Lad. There was a Smart Alec. We think that there was a Mickey Bliss who gave us Taking the Mickey, Bliss piss.
Bob's your uncle?
Bob's your uncle was Robert Balfour, who gave his nephew a job in government, even though he wasn't remotely suited for it.
I was looking up Jimmy Riddle. I wondered where that
Jimmy Riddle
came from. Yeah.
I haven't heard that as a phrase.
What's
that?
Going for a Jimmy Riddle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if this is the origins of it, but I looked in the newspaper archives for the earliest mention. And in 1866, there was an American song called Jimmy Riddle. So it was Come Union Men, One and All, and Learn How to Fiddle. We'll vote all day and sing all night for good old Jimmy Riddle. And it looks like it was related to James Buchanan, the president, because the rest of the song, it's about Martin Van Buren and slavery and all this kind of stuff. So it seems, I think, that it might be from James Buchanan, but I'm not a lexicographer. How do you prove that these are true or false?
It's so hard. And often people think, particularly with the Oxford English Dictionary, that a word's journey is complete and it's locked in, but that's absolutely not the case. So we're always finding new evidence.
Are you, as one of the leading UK people in this area, are you someone that if a new bit of info is found, they sort of come to you subtly before it gets released to the public? Do you get inside?
Sometimes I do, but honestly, there are brilliant people out there who are doing the detective work. So there was one lovely discovery, must have been maybe 10 years ago now, of hot dog and where that came from. And that was from students at Harvard who generally were eating from pretty dodgy vans and generally thought that they were eating dog. And so we were able to kind of date that. So it's things like that, which are wonderful. But when you say the leading, lexicographer, I'm the only one people know because we had so I always feel such an imposter. There are brilliant people.
But I would have thought hot dog was because sausage dog, because you get a sausage dog and then you're eating a sausage.
Yes.
Yeah. How interesting.
Yes. No, it was a poor joke at Bad Meat.
I have a question, Susie.
Yes.
Is there a word for things?
Do you get people coming up to you saying, "I've thought of a new word, Susie"?
No.
Yes.
Is there a word for
things
that you think are named the way they are for an ostensibly obvious reason, but actually they're named after a person who's got an amusingly apt name?
So an example that you will know is sideburns, which was named after Burnside, but you think it was the side of the face, right?
Yes. That's why it was flipped. Because you've got the side, people thought these were your burns. So,
I'm working on a short book of 1,000 of these.
Wow.
So,
well,
1,001.
1,001. I'm really hoping I get to.
He's got the one.
So, for example, you guys haven't heard this one yet.
Oh, yeah.
I've been torturing these two with these for a really long time.
A long time, Susie.
Recently, I found out about a New Zealand coffee company which is called All Press Espresso. It's named after the co-creator, Michael Allpress.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or French Park in Ireland, which is named after the French family. The Oberlin, Ohio, there's a place called the Carpool, which is named after Robert Carr.
Okay.
Who's the president of the of the college.
Do you remember there was a town in America called Snowflake that was named after Mr. Snow and Mr. Flake?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's that kind of thing.
Is there a word?
There is a word for this.
There's no word for these.
I don't know if there is. I think you need to invent one. And that can be the title of your book.
Yeah. Nice.
Have you got a title?
Well, at the moment it's called The Book of 1001 Things That You Think and Named the Reason They Are for an Obvious Reason, but actually they're named after someone with an interestingly apt name.
Yes.
But the editorial phase might winnow that down a bit. Yeah.
So your books have excellent names, Susie, I have to say. How do you think that one stands up?
I think it's novel.
Yeah.
It's actually nonfiction.
I know.
Do you think there's ever been a book that's had more words in the title than the book itself?
Yes. Does it form any acronym, that title, maybe?
Yeah, wanker.
Words.
Well, see,
that would be
autological then. If you could come up with something that fits, then
so they're like
Is
it an eponym that's named after a person? Mm. So they're like eponyms, but they are eponyms, but you don't think they're going to be eponyms.
Yeah. Someone emailed the Fish inbox with one of these, podcast@qr.com, and they suggested homonames, like homonyms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's not bad.
That's quite nice.
Yeah. Why are you laughing then?
I just can't believe that we've got into this territory.
We've got a lexicographer on. I'm not going to talk about my book. I'd like you to write the foreword, Susie, please. I know you did Brewer's Phrase and Fable. This will be going to be as eminent. So.
I'm just trying to think of other eponyms. Now I like it.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Like it. There's the quote for the front. That's all we needed. Thanks for coming in, Susie.
Yeah, yeah. Front and center, front page.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hey everyone, this week's episode of Fish is sponsored by Squarespace.
Yes, Squarespace is the place to go if you want to make a website. And who doesn't want to make a website these days? I've heard that this internet is a really up-and-coming place to be.
Yes, it's an amazing place. We're actually setting up a new website at the moment, which is Murray's Film Pitches. These are all of the cop dramas that Andy has been pitching on No Such Thing as a Fish over the years. And it's going to be amazing because Squarespace allows you to build extraordinary things within the body of your website. It gives you templates, it gives you fonts, it gives you images that you can use. It has a shop, so you could buy one of Andy's pitches on paper and read it for yourself. You can donate. There can be funding. There are so many things that you can do. And if you're one of those people who just doesn't know how to make a website, use the internet in that way, this is the kind of place that just makes it as simple as anything.
Absolutely. So if you would like to make yourself another website, perhaps it's not about a random word next to the word cop and turning that into a show, then you can do so by going to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, if you go to squarespace.com/fish, you can save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
That's right. So save that 10% now. Go to squarespace.com/fish and use the offer code FISH when you make your purchase.
Okay, hear me out.
Oh, yeah.
Website designer cop.
It's beautiful.
On with the podcast.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that the smarter your best friend's mum is, the smarter you will be.
Mm. Dan, your best friend's mum must have been a real thickie.
I don't have any friends.
How rude.
I'm so sorry. I'm telling Debbie, and you will regret that.
So this is research. They're like old research would say that the smarter your family are, the smarter you might be. Now, that might be genetics, or it might be just because your family, you know, are richer, for instance, or lots of different reasons. But there have been some new researchers who have looked at something called the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, which followed students for more than a decade and asked them loads and loads of questions. They did loads of questionnaires. And in part of it, they were asked the name of their best friend. And so these people could look at the best friend and then look at their family and work out if there was any correlation. And they found actually there was a real correlation between the success of the best friend's mum and the success of the child. And they don't know why it is. There's lots of reasons it could be. Yeah. But they checked it against various different things like, you know, affluence and all that kind of stuff. And they still reckon that this works out really well. And they don't know why.
It's crazy.
Because your best friend then is modeling their mum so that you were
surrounded. Yeah, it could be that.
You then model them.
I did a bit of first-hand research on this.
Oh, yeah.
Found out my best friend. Asked about his mum.
Yep.
She's got 2 degrees.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, there's always
exceptions and outliers.
Yeah. Well, that is interesting.
But this is all about, like, how do you judge people's intelligence, really?
Yeah. Alfred Binet, or Binet, depending on your pronunciation. He was the sort of proto IQ test creator. He was creating a test that were looking specifically at children to work out what schooling they would need.
And they were trying to find less able children via these tests so that they could receive more help academically.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But he never thought that it should be used in the way that we are currently using it in order to assess what intelligence is.
No.
That sort of just grew out through different evolutions by further scientists and psychologists down the line.
He was French, wasn't he?
Binet, yeah.
Yeah.
He coined the phrase erotic fetishism in 1887.
Oh, so he's a man of... I've never heard that phrase before.
What?
I've not really heard that as a phrase.
It's not a day-to-day phrase that we all come across.
You just see it because of the pop-up ads on your Google, so Andy can't escape it.
But yeah, genius. One interesting thing is, etymologically, women can't have genius. And that's because in ancient Rome, it was a godlike soul that lay in the foreheads of men only. And the female equivalent was called the Iuno. So men would have genius and women would have Iunos.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I've just worked on a series called Secret Genius.
Yes.
Where there were so many women who were geniuses.
Sorry, I'm not saying that women are not geniuses.
I know.
The phrase, etymologically speaking, was doing a lot of heavy lifting in that fact.
No, it's really interesting.
What kind of people did you find on your show?
Well, primarily we wanted to find people who didn't know how brilliant they were, and all their friends knew that they had something special, but they hadn't been validated at school, or they bunked off school because they knew they were different but felt embarrassed by it and that kind of thing. So it was actually really lovely.
Were you tracking people via their children's best friends? Was that the method that you used?
I think that would be the logical thing now. That should be one of our criteria when we research.
Because there are so many different ways of cutting it. You know, is it... There are creative arts, there are scientific forms of genius, there are engineering forms
there's so much. Actually, it's very difficult to sort of have a hard and fast rule as to, you know, you fit this category and you fit this one. And emotional intelligence now, I think, is also being really recognised, which is great.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because there was a fact that did the rounds a few years ago that said 65% of Americans thought they were above average in intelligence.
Right.
And everyone's like, oh, idiot Americans. But actually, if someone asks you, are you intelligent? And you say, well, yes, I am, because I'm emotionally intelligent, or because I'm good at puzzles, or because I'm good at word games, or whatever, which you naturally would think, whatever your best thing is, you'd be like, yeah, I am great. Of course, 65% of people think they are, and they probably are.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
You guys.
Yeah.
Do you think that your partners, your wives, are... attractive or intelligent?
I think Dan's, yeah. Fenella, yeah, absolutely she is.
Dan's, that was plural. How do you know about my secret wife?
Fenella's listening going, well, I'm neither of those things, so there must be at least two others.
Well, the interesting...
Of course you do.
You married them. But you tend to think you've attracted someone gorgeous. Like if you're with someone, you tend to think your partner's really attractive, naturally. We do know there's an effect where people overrate how attractive they think their partners are. I'm not saying your partner is overrated.
Is this in the first few months, or this is just continually?
I think this is in general.
Okay.
I think you're just asking, basically, of course, because you're with them, you will say, well, I think that person's, you know, really gorgeous, whereas maybe a neutral jury of their peers might say they're reasonably good looking.
Yeah. This is so dangerous.
I know, I'm listening. I can hear listeners' marriages cracking up all over the place.
The trick is not to ask the people at the wedding what they think.
Absolutely. Our survey said... Well, the fascinating thing is that people also overestimate their partner's IQs by a thumping amount.
Because surely you think, well, they're smart because they
picked
me.
Right.
It's between 36 and 38 IQ points that people overrate their partner's intelligence. What it turns out is that your partner is a hideous moron. I'm so sorry.
I find that fascinating.
That's yeah.
Very funny. I mean, really,
much better to do that than underestimate, though, surely. Be awful if you just were completely disrespectful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're with them, you love them, you think they're terrific, you think they're attractive and intelligent.
Put them on a pedestal. I think that's really good.
Yeah.
There's another test, which is called MEGA. The MEGA test, which is like an IQ test.
That's Meg Castonia Great again, isn't it?
There was someone who was a very high scorer on it. And in fact, there was a record in the Guinness World Records up until 1990 for the highest IQ that someone has ever got. And it was a woman called Marilyn Vos Savant.
Oh,
yeah.
That is wonderful.
Yeah.
She's a totally... bearing out her name.
Brilliant. I read about her.
Yeah.
She's stunning.
She's stunning.
God, I'm sorry.
And smart.
I'm so sorry.
And you married her.
She in 1985, she was 10 years old, and she was recorded as having answered every single question right on an adult test.
Wow.
Now, according to the way IQ is done, which is where it's basically your IQ is, it's like a version of mental age. I mean, they're all
But it's dependent on your actual age, isn't it?
It's dependent on your actual age. So if you're, let me get this right, if you're 10 but you get the same as an average 15-year-old, supposedly you have an IQ of 150. Like it's roughly like that.
So if I'm 47 and I get the same as someone who's 70 years old, do I get 150 as well?
I'm not sure when the baseline age is. That's a really good point. But she was, at the age of 10, she did this test, which apparently gave her an IQ of 228. She became extremely famous. And for her work, she spent more than 20 years as an agony aunt.
Gosh,
answering people's dilemmas.
Emotional intelligence.
Ask Marilyn, it was called. And Marilyn. And there was a big moment in it where she popularized what is quite a famous mathematical problem now, which is the Monty Hall problem.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the Monty Hall problem, James, you'll probably explain it better, but if let's say you're on a game show, which I believe is why it's connected to it. Monty Hall was the host of a show, and you had three doors, and you had to pick one that you think the treasure is behind, or the prize that you're going to get, and then behind the two other doors are, say, goats or something. So you select your door, and then Monty opens one of the other two doors and shows a goat behind it. He says, okay, there's only two options now. Do you want to stick with your choice or do you want to change it? The problem suggests that you should then change it because your odds are higher.
Almost everyone says I should stick, or they say it doesn't matter, it's 50-50 now.
Why are the odds higher?
Sorry?
Why are the odds higher then if you
switch? Well, one way of looking at it is if there's 100 doors... and you choose one, and then he removes all of them apart from the last two. So he's taken out 98 doors. You now know that it's either in your door or the other one. But most of the time when they removed 98 doors, yours would have been one of them. But in this case, it wasn't. So there's a decent chance that yours is empty.
You're going from odds of 1 in 3 to odds of 1 in 2, and you're re-choosing.
You're now going into odds of 2 in 3, actually.
Oh, of course, of course.
And this,
but it's very counterintuitive.
It breaks, it breaks everyone's brain.
Honestly, it's crazy.
And it did at the time because she popularized this idea. I think she might. I want to say she came up with it, but I'm not 100%. But 10,000 people wrote in saying, "No, that's not the case," including 1,000, nearly 1,000, who had PhDs. And in fact, Paul Erdos, the mathematician,
Hungarian
mathematician, he's kind of noted as one of the most prolific in the world. He refused to believe it and was only convinced when a computer simulation showed that her predictions were correct.
It's like mystical almost, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you know a quick way to score higher on your IQ test if you do one?
It's not something you're trying to cheat, though, is it?
Yeah, but what's interesting is they have noticed that the same person doing an IQ test actually can get differing scores based on a certain thing.
So it must be something physical you can do in the room to quickly improve the blood flow to your brain, for example, like shaking your head really fast.
That's okay.
Run into the wall. Run into the wall and bang your head into the wall.
Mr. Harkin and Mr. Murray were asked to leave the IQ seminar.
Pencils up your nose.
Yeah. What is it?
It's not that, no.
Is it just practice? Like, because those puzzles, I tend to be able to get a lot of those puzzles, but I don't think it's because I'm smart. I think it's because I've seen the puzzles before.
Yeah, no, it's not that. And this is some research that was done by friend of the podcast, Angela Duckworth, who appeared on the 20-hour marathon that we did. She was over in America. They found, so if I was, let's say, my oldest son, Wilf, if he was about to do it, if just before I said, I'm going to pay you $20, if you do well on this.
Oh, incentivize.
The money incentive will make him do better in the IQ test. It will change his
Did you try this on your show, Susie? We'll bung you 20
just
quid.
Offered them a hug. Yeah.
But you said before, I think, on this show that that's how you get your kids to do anything, like brush their teeth. You give them 20 quid.
I'm really broke. We need more. Please subscribe to the Clubfish on Patreon, everyone. Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is Andy.
My fact is, by the year 1600, everyone's tongues were slightly higher in their mouths than in the year 1400, and nobody knows why.
Oh, that's amazing.
Not that high. Okay. Split the difference.
Oh, so it's on that, because when you said this, I thought it was like in the palate, but it's not that.
It's, well, okay, this is a thing that is one of the most bizarre elements of the English language, and it's really well established that it happened in our language. You know, other languages around the world may definitely have had it, but it's a thing that started in roughly the 15th century and lasted for roughly 200 years, where everyone started saying a particular kind of letter, long vowels. So that's things like the A in cake, rather than the O in hot. That's a short vowel.
Yeah.
But so if it sounds like the vowel A, cake, it's a long vowel.
Yeah, yeah. Which, by the way, is impossible to teach to kids. Like, I'm teaching my daughter how to read right now, and she keeps reading the words slightly wrong. I'm like, no, that it is actually an I.
This is exactly so hard. Oh, if you're teaching anyone to read like a child, you have to, in English, you have to keep saying, no, that's just one of these funny things.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can't talk about the great vowel shift, which is what this is called. But it, basically, Middle English, you would hold vowels for a long time, and then people started moving their tongues slightly differently while saying these long vowels, and it caught on. And there is not a guaranteed explanation of why this happened. There are lots of theories, but it's why you have to say, oh yes, cough doesn't look at all like dough. And it's why Chaucer doesn't rhyme to us. If you read the Canterbury Tales, you think this guy was a moron. But actually, a hideous moron. Actually, he was probably...
This is Chaucer's like, well, actually, for me...
He was a beautiful genius. And, you know, all of these words have changed their pronunciations. So, you know, sheep, what we would call a sheep, they would call a shape.
Yeah. And,
you know, your wife.
I think this settles, by the way, the scone versus scone debate, because I think we should just call them scones.
Scone.
And then we'd be fine. There would be no.
Absolutely.
It sounds like you're from Yorkshire, though, when you say that. Scone.
It might. Yeah. Well, probably regionally, it's a bit different. Uh-huh. You know, your wife was once your weave.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Is this the same as the wife of Bath being the wife of Bath, or is that a slightly different thing?
I think that's different.
Yes, that is more regional. Okay. Yes. And the wife, weef, we just meant woman, by the way. It wasn't a wife. Yeah.
Mm. There's old spelling and new spelling. Does the old spelling reflect how it was being pronounced? As in, we obviously don't have recordings from the 1500s, so that's how we know it was being pronounced differently.
This is the whole problem.
Right.
The spelling hasn't changed and the pronunciation did.
Yeah,
we're
so
still
how
speaking.
Do we...
So yes, spelling and sound divorced centuries ago. Well, we know because we can interpret from rhymes quite a lot.
Right.
And we literally are just sort of sifting through evidence to try and work out how they were pronounced at the time, because as you say, we didn't have audio.
So, did no one at the time think to do a phonetic... Were there books that were teaching?
Plague. They were dying of plague, Dan. They were busy.
That sounded ruder than I meant it to. Apologies to the Middle Ages.
When Dan goes back in time, he's going, come on, guys, you just need to think of a phonetic.
But even then, they didn't have the International Phonetic Alphabet or anything. So even then, we wouldn't have been able to interpret. They could have said, you know, cat as in cart or something.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't know how cart was pronounced at the time. So a phonetic... glossary
wouldn't exist.
Wouldn't know.
But poetry is massive for it. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're telling me that right now the theory we've gone for is that our tongues were in a different bit of our mouth.
They were. Why?
Well, one theory is that the Black Death was just shuffling everyone around, and people were migrating more towards London, and Londoners were more fashionable and more elite, or that the French were more elite, so we copied them. I mean, there are loads of theories.
It could be the thing you can say in any history essay, the growing middle class.
You
can say that at any point in the last 2,000 years, because actually there was a burgeoning middle class at the time, and this changed how things were said, you know, possible. Yeah.
But, it could be due to speaking French or avoiding speaking French. I've seen both of those theories, which is basically either because the aristocracy were switching from French to English, and the middle class were kind of speaking French a little bit, but speaking it wrong, a bit
mangling
like
it, yeah,
the guy from Hello, Hello, I kind of think, good morning, or that there was anti-French sentiment because we were at war with them quite a lot, and there was a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
The printing press kind of came along mid-shift, so the printing press did more than anything to sort of solidify spelling. Or not solidify it, but to standardise spelling, thanks to Caxton, because before that was completely chaotic. But the sound changes kept happening. So we are still typing as though we're in the 15th century, but we sound much later.
Yes. Isn't that crazy? If we'd only not developed the printing press, or if we only had had the great vowel shift 200 years before, it would be easy to learn English now. Yeah. And there wouldn't be all these mad exceptions where you just say, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to remember that for the rest of your life, that it's a bit different, that one. It's so crazy. But now, because spelling has been pretty well pinned and isn't changing, I guess it's not changing as fast as it would have done, you know, 1,000 years ago, because things were sliding all over the place, but we'll never spell handbag, which is what people say.
Well, we might do. I mean,
I hope so. Bring your handbag.
A handbag.
A handbag.
That was what the confusion was in the play. No one talks about that. So weirdly, by researching this fact, I've sort of developed a personal theory about my accent, because I do have a weird accent. I was born and raised in Hong Kong, lived in Australia, and then moved here. And I put R's. I have a forced R in a lot of stuff. So listeners of this show know that I say Covent Garden as opposed to Covent Garden.
Covent. Oh, nice.
I put an R right at
Holborn
the end.
Holborn instead of Hoban?
Or Chicago I put in there. Yep. And what I realized was when I moved to Australia, I had a very American accent. And when I got there...
Because you went to an international school.
In Hong Kong, yeah, that's right. And in Australia, I went to a very, just down the line, Aussie school. And I was worried about the accent, but the first day, a girl who I found very pretty, called Penny, said, love your accent. And I thought, oh, okay, cool, I'm going to keep this. And I think I made an active effort to not lose my accent at a period where I would have been losing it. And I think the forced R is what that was.
Penny's fault.
Yes.
Yes, it's the attractive R, not the intrusive R.
Well, you think it's an attractive R.
But yeah, I think that's probably it. That may be how accents develop. It's, as you're saying, a reluctance to not be French, you know.
Yes, or to sound cooler and sound like a Londoner. Or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How interesting.
On a little other element of Middle English, there was a brilliant piece on, I don't know why it was on BBC Future, because it's about language 1,000 years ago. But anyway, it was a brilliant piece about how 1,000 years ago, everyone had more pronouns than they do today. Because English had all these pronouns that we just have naturally sounded off the language. So there was wit, which we have the word we, meaning me and one person, or more than one person. Mm-hmm. We can be two people, three people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone. Wit is specifically we two.
Okay.
So it's a word.
I see.
And it's a, you know, there are poems where it's we two. Yeah. And it's sort of used as a romantic thing, you know.
That's interesting.
We two.
We two. Yeah, exactly.
If you're with an owl.
And if there's our as well. But our can be multiple people or it can be two people. And you would have unca for mine and one other person's. So there were all these pronouns that we used to have. So in the old days, if you asked someone, what are your pronouns? Like, you'd be there a while because, you know, it's just like, look, there were loads more. Yeah, just find that so interesting. Yeah, or git for you too.
Git.
In serious.
Oh, I like that.
That's so interesting. Because English, I think, used to have... Or like in a real, real long time ago, we had more cases, right? That we've just lost over the years.
Yeah,
so like
ones.
In German or Russian, you have all these different genitives and datives and all that. And you can still see some of them, especially in short words like the and they and all that kind of stuff. They've still kind of hung around a little bit.
Yeah, I love that because we are Germanic at heart, but then we kind of, you know, as you say, so many influences.
Do you speak more than one language, Susie?
Speak German.
Okay.
So German was my first love, and French and a tiny bit of Spanish, but don't test me. And a tiny bit of Finnish because I was an au pair in Finnish ambassador for a while. I can talk about going to buy an ice cream, but that's about it. Finnish must be the most difficult language to learn, surely.
Yeah,
I've
heard
that. Many declensions and things. Yeah.
Is it kiitos in Finnish means thank you or something?
Thank you.
Yeah. I was taught you basically say mosquitoes with a soft ending and then lose the moss. And that's how you say it.
Right.
And if you have to learn that for every single word in the language, it's going to take you a long time.
Yeah.
We did a fact quite a long time ago on the show, which was, I think it was either Icelandic or Finnish, where there was a translator of Agatha Christie novels who spent over a decade trying to work out how to translate just two words in this one novel, because it was the giveaway, it was the reveal, and just couldn't work out to do it. Yes, yeah, so it took over a decade.
They don't have butlers in Iceland. Amazing. We talked about the phonetic alphabet earlier.
Yeah.
The most recent consonant added to the international phonetic alphabet is the labial flap.
Ooh,
crumbs.
It looks. It looks like a V with a little tail at the top.
I know what it looks like, James.
Grow up. It's a very rare speech sound produced by quickly drawing the lower lip back behind the upper teeth and then releasing it forward. And it's found in some sub-Saharan languages.
Wow.
But the rarest one I could find, I think this is the rarest. I saw this on TikTok with someone called Human1011, and they talked about the voiceless labial velar implosive, which is like pronouncing a K and a P at the same time, but instead of putting air out of your mouth, you suck it in. I couldn't do it. Well, he did. But it's in a single dialect of a single language. Of Igbo, which you get in Nigeria.
Wow.
But yeah, it's only used in that one tiny bit, but it's there.
Cool.
You know.
Very cool.
Yeah.
There must be more out there that we haven't discovered.
I'll be honest, it was mostly about just saying labial flap. All
absolutely.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hey everyone, this week's episode of Fish is sponsored by NordVPN.
Absolutely. VPNs, very important things in the 2026 world, especially for me as I've just been to China and they have the great Chinese firewall, which means it's very difficult to go on any website. If you want to go on the BBC and see how Premier League football results are going, it's impossible in China unless you have a VPN. And so I got myself a NordVPN when I traveled out there, and I managed to see that West Ham and Spurs are really struggling. Hooray!
That's amazing. I mean, this is the extraordinary thing. A VPN does allow you access into 137 countries that you can realign your VPN to so that your computer thinks you're in that country. And if you're on things like Netflix, for example, it means you can access all the movies that are blocked off from your country, and now you can sit and watch them. So it's a really useful thing to get. And if you yourself want to get involved with that, we've got good news. We've got a little plan for you here. NordVPN are offering a 2-year plan plus 4 months extra, and all you need to do is go to nordvpn.com/fish.
Absolutely. NordVPN, that's nordvpn.com/fish, and it's risk-free because Nord give a 30-day money-back guarantee on their VPN plans. So go there now. On with the podcast.
On with the show.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that many of Charles Dickens's readers in Victorian England consumed his works as audiobooks. This is a little fun little detail from a book by Amy Cruz called The Victorians and Their Books. And there's an extract in it, an account from the time of when Charles Dickens was over in Paris and his son was sick and he was staying in the lodgings. And I believe that the boy's grandmother was looking after him. And so she said to the carer of the house, "Mr. Dickens is coming." And the housekeeper was believed to have been illiterate, but said, "Oh, Mr. Dickens, I love his work." She thought, how do you read? And so she explained that there is a little snuff shop, and the man who works there would invite people in on the first Monday of every month, and he received a little payment, and in return they got some tea, but they also were read extracts from the latest bit of a Charles Dickens novel. So effectively, great. If you couldn't read, you might pay someone to be the audiobook for you.
Yeah.
And you get groups of people to do that.
Even if you could read, I can imagine that'd be quite nice.
Yeah.
Having someone reading your story.
Yeah.
It was a big thing, wasn't it? I mean, in the earlier 19th century, Jane Austen's time, reading to your family was one
was
of the things
thing
that you
after
do.
Dinner, yeah. wasn't it? Yeah, poetry. Yeah. Or... Cool. But Dickens was a huge performer of his own works, wasn't he? I mean, yes. They said that it really damaged his health in the end.
Yeah, the way he really him.
Yeah,
did
yeah.
it?
Way, yeah, he I'll just kill him. To Bill Sykes and things, he gave so much sort of himself.
Oh,
just
wow.
performances. Yeah, and his yes. performances that it, he was warned not to do it by his doctors.
How interesting, because wow. There was a train crash that occurred not long before yes. he died, where he got very ill. So he was still performing afterwards, was he?
He wasn't hurt himself, I think, but it was incredibly shocking to be.
Yeah, I think psychologically.
Yeah. Really, yeah.
We said before that, like before his shows, he would drink a lot of champagne.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Like a pint of champagne.
Yes.
Yeah. So that might have had an effect. We don't know. You know, maybe all the raw eggs he
maybe.
Also had before
yeah.
he died. Yeah, yeah, it could be. So this is interesting. Audiobooks didn't exist.
Yeah.
But we have a recording of A Christmas Carol exactly as Dickens would have read it. And in fact, read by Dickens. But Dickens died with no recordings of his voice being made. Little me this.
AI.
AI. That's it. It's AI.
Yeah.
It's not, is it?
No, it's the new Robo Dickens. Every household will have one in 10 years' yes. time. It's really exciting. No.
Is okay. Is it a descendant who just looks very similar to Dickens? And it's that, is
That's
it?
It's so annoying. Dan's got it.
Is that is it?
It was read by A. Dickens, but not V. Dickens. It was read by Monica Dickens, yeah. who was his great-granddaughter, yeah. herself a novelist.
She was.
She wrote 40 novels.
Oh, my God, wow. I picked up a book by her today.
Yeah, yeah, they're really good.
She had listened to her grandfather, i.e. Charles Dickens' son, reading A Christmas Carol, lots.
Yeah.
And he had a version of A Christmas Carol which had all of the original Dickens annotations in it, which words to stress, which words to leave out, which way to lean this and that. So it was properly annotated. And she, in 1950, recorded that version of A Christmas Carol. So cool. Weirdly, through four generations, we have the Dickens-approved version of A Christmas Carol.
How amazing. Have you seen The Great Christmas Feast, which is a brilliant performance that goes on every Christmas where they recreate Dickens reading A Christmas Feast to all of you who sit around in Dickensian clothes eating great Dickensian food? It's brilliant.
Really good.
That experience. Sounds awesome.
But he definitely would have a Patreon, wouldn't he? Dickens now.
Yeah.
He was a one-man podcaster, really.
He really was.
Not that there's anything wrong with having a Patreon.
No. Or being a podcaster. Yeah. What are you trying to say?
But yeah, he taught it a lot, didn't he? And he went to America even and taught it around there and apparently didn't really like it very much. He complained to his friends that he could do nothing that he wanted to do, go nowhere I want to go, and see nothing that I want to see. If I turn into the streets, I am followed by a multitude. Because he was so famous.
We've been on tour, though. It's like that. It's just like that, you know.
Couldn't wander through Times Square without being mobbed. But when he was in America, he was there. He did his show and stuff, but he also wanted to put the idea of an international copyright forward. Because at the time, everyone was copying his works in America and he wasn't getting any of the cash for it. And so he went around saying, okay, I'm going to do my bit, but then also you guys should pay me for your books. It's not really fair. Mm. And the press, the American press, really just did not like him. And they said he was mercenary. They said he was only coming to America for monetary gain, all this kind of stuff. And then in his next novel that he wrote, Martin Chuzzlewit, Martin Chuzzlewit goes to America and says, this place is a shithole. And he really fell out with the Americans.
Wow.
It's
really interesting. The copying and the plagiarism, I think we might have mentioned before that Dickens was pirated a lot.
Yeah.
Because he released them bit by bit, people could piggyback on that and then overtake him. So plagiarists would pump out works like Oliver Twist, Martin Guzzlewit, or whatever. And there was one particular press baron called Edward Lloyd who hired 10 or 50 writers to just churn these things out, get them on the streets before Dickens has released his next chapter or whatever it is. And Dickens did sue over one, saying this is outrageous. But the judge in the case, I love this, who was called Sir Lancelot Shadwell.
Yes, please.
Said, these are so bad that they don't meet the test of plagiarism or pirating. No one could possibly be fooled.
Oh, really?
By Nicholas Nickleberry or whatever.
It
is not good enough to be plagiarism.
Yeah. How interesting.
Would that still work if I write a really awful version of Game of Thrones and I can get away with it?
I think there are laws about parody and there are tests. Do you remember the moron in a hurry?
Oh, the man on the omnibus or something.
Yeah, like if a moron in a hurry can still tell the difference between your work and the original, then it's fine. Yeah. That's it. But if they would be fooled, then it might be a problem.
Yeah, but you leave my wife out of this.
Do any of you know about UK Red?
UK Red.
Have you heard about this, Susie? No. This is a open access database housed at Open University, and it contains 30,000 easily searchable records documenting the history of reading in Britain from 1450 to 1945. And you can put in someone like Charles Dickens, and it will show you a track record in time of who has been reading, let's say in this case, Charles Dickens.
Oh.
I found this in an article by someone called Mary Hammond. So, for example, it shows Victorian professional criminals when they were reading books in prison. There's an example of the novelist in the 1850s, Elizabeth Gaskell, reading a little bit of Little Dorrit over the shoulder of a passenger on a bus and being frustrated that she had to get off before her companion turned the page. There was A.A. Milne, who read Oliver Twist at the age of 9 and it gave him nightmares. A man called Newman Flower, who in 1901 rose at 4 a.m. to watch the funeral procession of Queen Victoria pass by, but whiled away the hours reading Bleak House, but got so engrossed in the book, he completely missed it.
Oh, no. Yeah. No offense, but depending on the bit of Bleak House, it's not always totally easy to completely lose yourself in it. I'd say you're quite distracted.
That would have been everything.
But isn't that amazing? UK That's Red, stunning. Highly recommend checking
it
out. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Really cool.
I find it quite interesting that, because there is a sort of silent shame about audiobooks these days, isn't there? That you just sort of said, I've read it technically.
Yeah.
But it's a deep Victorian tradition.
Mm.
And I think this is brilliant. I think we should be proud.
Do you think it's if you read the audiobook, you get as much out of it than if you read the actual words?
If you listen to the audiobook, sometimes... I would say it depends. It depends so much on the narrator, doesn't it?
I think science pretty much agrees with sometimes it depends.
Yeah.
Because I've found a few studies. There was one in 2016 where they played sections of a book to some people and then the other ones read it. And then they did a quiz and actually everyone kind of took in the same amount of information.
Mm.
And then there's one slightly more recent where... they did the same thing, but this time they asked them trick questions. So it's like the kind of trick question is like, how many of each animal did Moses take on the ark? And the answer is
two.
Nope.
Moses
didn't. Moses, take it wasn't Moses, yeah.
So it's that kind of trick question. So they asked the people that kind of question, and they found that the people who had read the book were less likely to be tricked. So it's almost like you still take it in, but you don't process it quite as much. That's what they said.
Right. Often you're listening to an audiobook while doing something else.
Yeah.
Whereas reading a paper book, you can't be driving a bus, for example.
It's true.
You know, so I think that probably makes a bit of a difference in the real world. Yeah.
I wonder if the brain also provides a little bit of white noise when you're reading, because you can sort of pause or whatever. Because there's also really interesting research that involved two recordings being played to an audience, one with all the white noise, the ums, the ahs, the fillers and things kept in, and another one where it was entirely stripped out. And the one where it was kept in was remembered best.
Oh, interesting.
Because it gives you a bit of time to absorb.
That's
as long as it's not over the top.
I tend to allow one per sentence, really.
Yeah.
That's probably enough.
We could double our numbers if you leave in all of our stumbles.
There's a sweet spot, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like in Love Island just drives everyone mad, doesn't it? So I think too many, and then the reverse is true. But
interestingly, anytime we read, this is for most of us, we are listening to the audiobook as we're doing it.
I think that's true.
Sub-vocalization. Yeah. It's a thing that happens where most of us, when we're reading the words in our head, we can hear our voice reading it. And in many cases, the muscles in your throat that would be moved to make sound are very subtly making those movements as well. Yeah.
And some people mouth, quite obviously.
And some people mouth. And so apparently you also can only go at the speed at which you read.
But you can read faster and slower.
Yeah, you can, but you can't break any kind of... You can't trick your brain into going faster. Yeah.
How interesting. And there was all this debate about whether people... In olden times, had the capacity to read silently.
Yeah, because there was one guy, wasn't there, from like the 9th century, and someone wrote, amazingly, he can read without talking. Like,
yeah.
And that was taken as evidence that actually no one could do that before.
Yeah.
But gosh.
I'm not sure that that's
I don't know. I think there's still debate going on about that, or it was a bit of a dubious one.
It was quite fun. I was I was thinking about Audible and how you get any kind of book you want now. And you can put an actor's name in and you can get whatever they've read. So there are some people who have quite iconic voices. And it's quite funny when they're paired up with certain books. So, for example, you can read a book called The Savior is Born, which is the story of the Nativity, from the voice of God. Morgan Freeman.
Oh.
Yeah. You can be read the Bible by Mufasa, which is James Earl Jones. Oh. Or arguably Darth Vader's reading it to you. It's quite fun, these kind of iconic voices. That
but they strip out all the...
Yeah.
You know, one per sentence.
Yeah.
But in the future, we'll be able to just pick a voice, pick a text and match them, won't we?
Yes.
Which is quite scary.
Actually, James Earl Jones is a good example because he's given over the rights to his voice for any future Star Wars, so they can now AI Darth Vader into...
I mean, you could do it now, not legally, I reckon.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much, you probably wouldn't take much to take Susie's voice and then do an audiobook just with AI, I reckon.
Yeah.
Melania Trump's memoir in 2024.
I'm not doing that one.
She announced that it would be the future of publishing because it was an AI voice that was doing her audiobook.
Everyone else refused. Yeah.
Well, one of the main companies in the field, 11 Labs, said that the product lacked the nuanced emotional expression of an actual person.
Sorry, are we talking about the book or the readings?
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on Instagram on @Schreiberland. James?
I'm on TikTok. No such thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
My Insta's Andrew Hunter M.
Yep. And Susie, where do we find you?
Instagram @SusieDent.
Nice, cool. And yeah, Susie, you're on tour at the moment, right?
Yes. It's called Word Perfect, and it is just a one-woman show where I just talk words. We have a laugh, I hope. Some silly videos, sort of facts that you guys hopefully would love. And I have a Q&A section, which is my favourite bit. So there's a sort of word surgery where people can ask me anything they want within reason.
And yeah, do follow Susie on Instagram. And if you want to write about any of the stuff we've spoken about in this episode generally to us, you can do that by emailing podcast@qi.com. All the emails make their way to Andy. He cherry picks the best of them and he separates them into two groups. The first group is the facts. We love picking the facts out for our new Monday show that we've been doing called Little Fish. It's a bonus episode.
Oh, yeah.
We put down our facts, we pick up yours, and we read the best of them out. And then we also use the second pile as part of Drop Us a Line, which is our mailbag show. And that's a sort of private secret members club that is on Patreon. It's called Club Fish. There's lots of tiers, lots of rewards, lots of interesting things that you can check out there if you're a fan of the show. So do go there. And
go where, Dan?
patreon.com/clubfish.
I love it.
It's great. It's great as a web domain, and you should enjoy it too. Anyway, you can otherwise just come back here because we're going to be back with another episode next week, and we will see you then. Goodbye.